We're using this last week of the year to revisit some notable interviews of the past in our second hour. Today you'll hear our 2013 interview with John Whitehead, the author of an unsettling book called A Government of Wolves. Since this interview is pre-recorded, we are unable to take any new phone calls or emails today. Here's that interview. Putting your shoes and belt and cell phone and coins into a plastic tub at the airport is a regular thing now, and it may not seem like a great inconvenience or intrusion, but have you ever flunked that metal detector test and had a TSA person put a hand in your pants? And what about all the other methods of scrutiny, the ones you're not aware of? John W. Whitehead writes about these in his book, A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. John Whitehead is an attorney and author, a fierce defender of constitutional rights, and the founder of the Rutherford Institute, and our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. John, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So for the benefit of newer listeners, what is the Rutherford Institute?
The group's about 30 years old. I founded it in 1982, which would make it 31 years old. Basically, I'd worked with various civil liberties groups and had a very broad idea who I wanted to defend. I don't matter. Political viewpoint, I'm not political. I'm nonpartisan. So I've defended every stripe of human being. And when we take on a case, we don't charge. So I raise money to defend people in the courtrooms because, as you know, lawyers are expensive. But, you know, I've handled people on the left, the right, the middle, libertarians, Republicans, Democrats. Many constitutional cases. You can go to our website at Rutherford.org and see all the cases we've been involved in. Many, by the way, which I detail in my book, A Government of Wolves.
You do seem to find different allies for different civil liberties.
Yeah, and I often find, too, when I get in a case, I can draw from the left or right. In fact, I'm affiliated with groups on the left or right that are concerned about civil liberties. I work with the ACLU, various groups out there that are doing good work.
Well, you can't judge a book by its cover, John Whitehead, but the cover is certainly provocative. It shows riot police in the streets in front of the U.S. Capitol. It's obviously an illustration. And then this shadowy picture superimposed there as well with Uncle Sam looking like the DC Comics character, the Spectre. It's really Uncle Sam as Boogeyman. A little on the heavy side, or is this just about right?
Well, I think with the NSA revelations, Edward Snowden, what he's basically given us, the information he's given us, and again, I have a section in the book on the National Security Agency, and the book is selling well. One reason is it hit just about the time Edward Snowden dropped his bomb of information. So, and again, I know NSA agents. I've worked with them. I have friends who work in the NSA, and everything I say in the book, they confirm. In fact, I have several NSA agents have read the book. They really like it, which is kind of strange. But there are good people within the government that are really upset and nervous about what's happening. The NSA is listening to everything we do. I've been told by NSA agents that nothing, anything digital now, your bank records, text messages, Facebook posts, all those things are being watched. There's a massive computer in Utah, in their Utah Center now, that actually the NSA consumes one-third of the entire intelligence budget. So they're the biggest group out there, and they coordinate with the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI and their activities. And, I mean, we had a case this time last year where a Marine, he'd just gotten back, he served in Afghanistan and Iraq, he's made some anti-government statements on his Facebook page. Didn't target anybody or anything. He was arrested and pulled from his home by the Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security, and put in the mental institution. We got him out in a week, and now he was only in there a week, but a lot of those people, they're called civil commitments.
Was that Brandon Robb?
Brandon Robb, yep. He disappeared. But a lot of those people, and again, when I got in the case, I didn't understand the nature of civil commitments where they could just arrive at your door. You commit no crime, and they put you in a mental institution. There's 1.5 million plus of those that occur annually now across the United States. You know, obviously some legitimate, but the thing about Brandon Robb, his mother and sister got on the internet, contacted us, and I actually called the police after they arrested him. You can go on our website, Rutherford.org, by the way, and see the arrest video. He just was saying these things, and they grabbed him and took him away and put him in jail. But they were reading his Facebook posts. He even was in a private grouping playing a game, and they got into that, the government, and read it and saw what he was doing. But again, a judge ruled there was absolutely no shred of evidence to keep him. But again, the scary thing here is they're watching everything you're doing. Everything.
All right, but he raises a particular issue. You raise a particular issue with him. I mean, with the fact that Brandon Robb used Facebook, I mean, there's a mixture here, isn't there, of our info being taken away versus us just kind of giving stuff away?
Yeah, exactly. But I guess the question is, why is the government concerned about again, the police, I've been in this area 40 years. I work with police, intelligent people, Secret Service personnel. They all say that 99% plus of Americans are not terrorists or dangerous at all, basically. And in fact, violent crime has dropped so radically over the last 20 years that why would they be concerned about what I'm texting, what's on my Facebook page, and those kind of things? But, again, you're being watched. That's surveillance. If the government watches you, our Fourth Amendment, and I encourage Americans to read it, it says the government's not supposed to be doing that. You're supposed to be secure in your home, persons, papers, and effects. They have to have some kind of evidence you're up to something illegal before they're watching you, or it's what we've called a police state in the past.
You point out in the first section of A Government of Wolves, part one is called Is This America?, that this is fear. We're doing this out of fear, but you also lay the impression here that our country's very good at instilling fear in each other. Why are we so good at that, and is it that different from other cultures?
Well, I think we've learned from past regimes. In fact, I had a long time, he's retired now, NSA agent said, John, we're following the Soviet model now. I had no idea what he was talking about. So I looked into it. You know, the Soviets used a combination in the 60s and 70s and early 80s before the Iron Curtain supposedly fell. The Soviets used, they picked up people, they involved, you know, they committed them to the mental hospital. Sakharov, the great scientist, was tortured in a mental institution. They used Gestapo tactics, those kind of things. So, again, we've learned from past regimes. Hitler said it best. He says that repetition, the masses just go along if you use the right concept. In fact, Hermann Goering, one of Hitler's henchmen, says it works the same in every country. You just instill fear in people and they follow along. You clamor for security. And that's why, why I wrote the book. I want people to get educated and question the government. And we should be doing more of it in our schools, by the way, and we're not really doing that, teaching our kids to question, debate.
The book in question is called A Government of Wolves. John Whitehead wrote it. He joined us in August of 2013, and we're replaying that interview today on the Jefferson Exchange. Back to hear more of A Government of Wolves on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinle. Thank you for listening. We are revisiting an interview from a previous edition of The Exchange. Today, from August of 2013, John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute talking about A Government of Wolves, his book about his concerns about the United States turning into a police state. John Whitehead is disposed to think in these terms because he is a civil libertarian, but he makes a compelling case in the book. We will get back to the interview now with the reminder that, of course, since this is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. John, you've already established you're nonpartisan, that the Rutherford Institute, left, right, center, no matter what, you know, just libertarian, civil libertarian views. But just for a timeout question here, do you have the same concerns about the emerging police state, no matter which party's in power?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't really matter anymore because, as I show in the book, there's essentially a technocracy that runs government now. It's, executives. By the way, Aldous Huxley called the power elite in his A Brave New World Revisited. And I talk a lot about Huxley and Orwell in the book and modern sci-fi films that show where we're headed. But there's no way one president can run a country now. It's huge. Think about it. You have these huge computer systems, Department of Homeland Security, FBI. Who's going to run that? So the technocratic elite basically advised the president, the NSA, the agents. In fact, I had a NSA agent tell me the large computer they have in Utah actually parses the information. It hands it to the agent. In other words, the agent becomes an extension of the computer, in essence.
So the computer does the work, and then the agent...
The computer does the work and says, go. This guy may be a problem. The song lyrics he's quoting, which is what Brandon Robb did. That's a danger we've got to go get him. But here's, I think, the thing that people have to understand is technology is driving the show now. And a lot of our science fiction has pointed the way, as I detail in the book. The movie Minority Report, if you haven't seen it, go watch it at home on Netflix or whatever. Or if you have seen it, remember that movie is set in 2054. It's 40 years from now. The technology in that film, all of it now is available to the government or is in use somewhere. So we're 40
years except for the people in the tank who can see the future.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the average citizen, no. But, again, there's some good signs out there. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist. There are a lot of young people who call themselves hackers. I had one fellow who studied with me last summer in our summer intern program. He was a law student. He took me out to his car one day and said, "Mr. Whitehead, I want to show you something." Because I've written a lot about drones. So he opens the car and he unfolds this weird-looking thing. He says, "Here's my drone." He actually made a homemade drone. He flew it around my parking lot, let me see my face on his little machine he had there. And I looked at a television machine. And, you know, so there's a lot of people like that. And he said, "I want to develop drones that will resist the government drones that are coming." And drones, that's a big subject in my book. But as I said to him, the drones the government will have rubber bullets, tasers, scanning devices, dude. I mean, you're going to have to be careful doing that kind of stuff. But there are some young people out there that are thinking. They've seen the sci-fi films. They're reading the Harry Potter books and stuff like that, which basically prophesy a police state future.
Well, all right. So to get back to the point, though, about you not being taking a side politically, though, I mean, did you have a big issue with the Patriot Act right from the start?
Oh, yeah. I was one of the early opposition people to the Patriot Act. In fact, when I first started writing on the Patriot Act, it was 90% against. Well, people were calling me a traitor. Mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years later, the same people were going, "Hey, I see, you got a point."
How'd they write a big bill so fast is always the question a lot of people
have. It was written before it had to be. It was 400 pages, and it was passed a little over a month after 9/11. It's detailed. I mean, absolutely. I mean, allowing sneak and peek searches in your home where the FBI or the NSA can come in your home and download stuff from your computer and not tell you they've been there, to following your telephone calls. In fact, President Bush actually gave the NSA a project. He said, "I want to know who's calling here or there." And so about 320 million phone calls a day were being downloaded by the NSA during the Bush administration.
So this seems to only go in one direction, because given a chance to revise the Patriot Act, Congress didn't do it. And it seems like anybody who would advocate for a little less in the way of the intrusiveness ends up looking like a wuss, so they think they're going to anyway.
Or you're not for security and those kind of things. And again, I talked to Secret Service agents. In fact, I had a couple of people. There are a lot of older policemen that don't like the way the policemen are going with SWAT team raids, which is something we should talk about. But I had a former Secret Service agent tell me, he says, "You know why we didn't catch the Boston Marathon bombers?" And he said they were on a FBI watch list. The FBI had actually visited with them, knew who they were. He says, "Because the way we're doing intelligence work now, we're watching everybody. We're not doing old-fashioned police work anymore." You know, again, when someone's doing song lyrics or controversial and the FBI is showing up at people's door, which, by the way, is routine now for interviews, they're watching the wrong people. And the inventive terrorists are going to get through the network. And there are not a lot of terrorists. I mean, Secret Service people I talk to say there are not a lot of terrorists, but the wily ones are going to get through the network because we're too busy watching you and me.
John Whitehead's our guest on The Exchange. Let's take a call here for David in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, I just wanted to get Mr. Whitehead's comment on something I've observed, you know, especially when the Patriot Act passed. You know, one demographic of people will imagine a Muslim man with a turban, and they'll be all right with, you know, monitoring his phone calls. And then another demographic will think of, you know, let's say a Christian fundamentalist in Idaho with a beard, and they'll be all right with violating his rights and observations and observing him. So I'm just curious how you think we can bridge that gap among, you know, the partisan divide about who we feel deserves their right to privacy, and how you deal with that in your work.
All right. Thanks for that, David.
Well, I follow the law. The law in this country is our Constitution. The Fourth Amendment's really clear. Because someone has a beard, they wear a turban or a hoodie, by the way. That was another signal after the Boston Marathon. Does that make them, is that really probable cause to do surveillance? No. Because, again, we live in a very eclectic country, and the bright terrorists and criminals, they go where they want to commit crime. So it's very, very difficult. To give you an idea, surveillance cameras. I was on a project for 3 or 4 years. We studied surveillance cameras with constitutional authorities across the country. And about the time we were finishing our study, a British study came out showing that the surveillance and cameras in Great Britain, they have more per capita in any country in the world. What they do is they may catch occasional terrorists, but they displace crime to areas where there are no cameras. So, in other words, the criminals have already figured it out. If I'm going to commit a crime, I'm not going to do it on a camera. Only stupid people do that. So that's the environment we live in. We're looking for, you know, crazy things. But, again, if you follow the law is really clear. Before you do surveillance on an American citizen, you have to have probable cause, which means some evidence are up to illegality. Otherwise, we're all suspects and we're all potential criminals.
Let's take another call. Here's John in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Whitehead, author of A Government of Wolves. John, you.
Yeah. Oh, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious. Have you had experiences with or heard of experiences with U.S. Forest Service law enforcement getting out of hand? Because I've seen it happening a lot.
Yeah, that's a great question. Early 1980s, there were 3,000 SWAT team raids occurring annually. Now there are over 80,000. So there's been a 3,000% increase, yes. And I detail that in my book, The Militarization of the Police, which began in the early 1980s under the Reagan administration, by the way, when they the government, the Department of Defense, started handing out military equipment to every police station in the country that wanted them, police agency, and most of them took it, by the way. And now almost every police agency in the country has assault vehicles, assault weapons, body armor, Kevlar helmets, all the things, some helicopters. There's some small communities that have peacemakers, which are tank-like objects that have a turret on top and guns. And this is on American soil. So, yes, the police today dress militarily. They view us differently. In fact, as I show in my book, I have a section called The Psychology of Compliance. Studies show that when people put on certain kind of uniforms, military uniforms, they do become the military. They take on the military kind of law and order, kind of crash through doors. And we're seeing many no-knock raids now where the police are going through doors. I detail a number of cases, but one that's kind of tragic. A little over a year ago, a 7-year-old girl named Ayanna Jones was asleep in her Detroit apartment on her couch, wrapped in a princess blanket, 7-year-old. The police did a SWAT team raid on her apartment. They crashed through the door. One of the policeman's guns supposedly went off accidentally, shot and killed her. Her blood splattered everywhere. Her father comes out, seeing the daughter dead, starts screaming and crying. They push him face down in her blood. The actual guy they were looking for was 2 stories up. In other words, they crashed through the door. They killed somebody. They're not following the Fourth Amendment, where you have to have a warrant. You're supposed to identify yourself unless you have evidence that there's this dangerous criminal inside, but they're not checking a lot anymore. And, again, I detail more cases like that where people get killed. They shoot the dogs. You can go on YouTube and watch some of these raids. It will scare you. And they're happening. I mean, 80,000, and it's increasing.
All right, John Wairika, thanks for the call. John Whitehead, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. This is a version of the exchange from our archives. It is pre-recorded, so we're not giving out the phone number and the email address today because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Thanks. We can take these two threads that you've laid down here, the technocracy, as you point out, the pervasive use of computers, and the militarization of police that you identify in the book, but it ultimately gets down to the same sort of thing happening, where when you got a gadget, you're going to use it.
Yes.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that over time, police spend more time looking at the screens of their gadgets than looking at actual people.
Yeah, you know, you have fusion centers sprinkled across the country. I don't know. Government keeps kind of quiet about those, but there's at least 80 or plus that have been identified. They're collection centers. Again, they're all over the country. They watch everything from the license plate. The police use license plate readers now, which, by the way, are funded by the Department of Homeland Security to the tune last year of $50 million spent on license plate readers handed out to local police where they can detail wherever you've been. If you go to see, if you're a politician, let's say, and you have an alcohol problem, you go to an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting, they're going to know you're there. And they use those. And again, I detail some cases in the book where the government actually uses those to blackmail people. So those things are all over the country. They're continually collecting information on us. And it's not going to slow down. I mean, some people say, gee, we've got to put a brake on this. But, you know, again, our Congress, I petitioned Congress. I said, we need an electronic privacy bill of rights, getting Congress to move, because one thing that we have to understand here is that large corporate entities make a ton of money off of Kevlar helmets, body armor, computers, RFID chips, license plate readers, and down the line, things that governments are handing out free across the country. So we've moved, again, in the area, and again, this is why I point out in my book, I use Huxley and Orwell and a number of the sci-fi writers. They identified early on that the large corporate interests would join with the government, and you would have something that wasn't quite a government there to protect your rights, but to make money off of you, and eventually to control the populace, and generally control them. I'm not talking about criminals. I'm talking about general populace.
All right, but as a lawyer and as the founder of the Rutherford Institute, you are taking these cases to court. So as you go up the chain in the federal courts, what's generally been the response? Do you have any confidence that the current Supreme Court, for example, would have some issues with some of the practices out there?
Occasionally. There are some good judges on the courts. There are a couple of good judges on the Supreme Court. The present Supreme Court is very troublesome. To give you an example of a case, we had a case, and it's going up. Hopefully it's going to go up. The government has appealed it. But we defended a 45-year-old man named Harold Hodge. He's African-American. In 2012, it was snowing in front of the Supreme Court in January. He went out in front of the Supreme Court, way to the left if you're facing the U.S. Supreme Court in D.C. He had a sign around his neck. He had drawn himself with a black marker. It said, "The police in America brutalize African-Americans and Hispanics." He was arrested immediately and taken off the mall in handcuffs by the police. Again, no one was out there that day. He wasn't blocking ingress. The court wasn't meeting. There was a 64-year-old law, congressional law, saying it's illegal to be on the Supreme Court plaza. It's a huge plaza, by the way. I've been out there a number of times, communicating a message. Well, a judge ruled several months ago in our favor, saying that that law was repugnant to the Constitution. The next day, the Supreme Court passed its own law under the guidance of Justice Roberts, outlawing such practices. In other words, we're going to appeal that case. I mean, the government's going to appeal it. We're going to have to litigate it probably before the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court's already made their decision. So, I mean, when you got the Supreme Court making laws like that, it's a little scary, and we don't have really a civil libertarian court like we've had under former other presidents. It's just not there right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just today, yesterday, I should point out that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the Supreme Court justices, listed in an article in the New York Times describing the court she's on as one of the most activist ever. And it's first time in my lifetime I can remember one Supreme Court justice criticizing the whole realm of the Supreme Court while she's still on it.
Yeah, but, you know, she's delivered some good opinions. I give her credit. I mean, several years ago in Kentucky versus King, and this I talk about this case in my book, a SWAT team arrived at the wrong door. They were there, wrong place. They realized it, but they said they thought they smelled marijuana, so they crashed through the door and did their, you know, normal SWAT team thing, shooting the dogs and holding a gun to someone's head. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. In an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that if a SWAT team does arrive at your place and they don't have a warrant, but they think you might be doing something illegal, they can still go on and do their SWAT team raid. The only dissenting judge on that decision was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a great dissent where she said that this was the end of the Fourth Amendment. She says, if we allow this, I mean, it just means you've got stormtroopers now. And so she's delivered some pretty darn good opinions.
What is John Viper, V-I-P-R, in the book?
Viper is a organization. The actual name is Visual Intermodal Prevention and Tactics Squads. What they are, they work for the TSA. They've conducted almost 9,600 training exercises across the country where they shut down parts of towns, buildings, and those kind of things. They work with local police, all dressed in their black SWAT team gear, where they do these training exercises with local police. And, I mean, a lot of people get freaked out when they see that happening, but that's under the TSA. And, I mean, there are some people that tell me I'm very paranoid about this. And I quote them the Woody Allen quote out one of his movies where he was accused of being paranoid, and the guy says, you know what that means? And Woody Allen says, yeah, it means I'm very perceptive. But there are a lot of these training raids going on, and about this time last year, and this is something you have to think about, folks, the Department of Homeland Security actually purchased, contracted out to buy over 1 billion hollow point bullets that have now been handed out to the Department of Fisheries, the Social Security Administration, the IRS, and they all have their SWAT teams. Hollow point bullets, I'm a former infantry officer. We weren't allowed to use them because of what they do. They basically explode on impact and kill.
And they mushroom out and make a bigger hole leaving than they get in.
Small hole entering, large hole exiting. So they do kill you. The question is, why would the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Fisheries, Social Security Administration need hollow point bullets? I mean, it's over a billion.
All right. Well, I did check out the 174,000 for the Social Security Administration. It does pass the smell test. But the issue here is the defense, anyway, was presented as, well, yes, we have security teams. Yes, they are like police. Police generally do tend to carry hollow point bullets. Is there truth to that?
No, not most police don't. No, they don't. I mean, I talked to policemen, and I had policemen call me and say, well, this scares me now that they have hollow point bullets. I mean, but the question is a billion hollow point bullets. I mean, they were accused for a while of buying up ammunition, but they actually contracted to buy those. Those were made specially for the Department of Homeland Security.
John Whitehead from 2013, talking about his book, A Government of Wolves, here on the Jefferson Exchange, a replay of notable interviews from the past. We'll come back and hear more from John Whitehead when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. It's a year-end revisit, this one with John Whitehead from 2013, talking about his book, A Government of Wolves. Since it is pre-recorded, no new phone calls or emails today, please.
John, you use the term security theater in your book. Is some of what's going on out there just meant to impress people that they are protected and also to deter people who might cause problems?
By the way, that's not my phrase. That's police. Mm-hmm. That's a police phrase, and I want to say this. I work with a lot of good policemen. I work with a lot of good people in government who agree with what I'm saying and their concern. So that's a good sign as well. Security theater, I think what we see with the Viper raids, closing down buildings and neighborhoods, those kind of things, it kind of indicates that the government's on their toes and doing their job. And that may be true to a certain extent, but security theater, I think, is going to become more and more something that we see that gives us the indication that there are all these dangerous people running around out there. But if 2013 is true, if we end 2013 like it's headed, this is going to be the lowest murder rate in America in over a century. So Americans aren't generally violent. The question is, why do we see all the SWAT team raids, all the snooping on us, and those kind of things? And again, I kind of answer that in the book because we've just changed the way we look. I've had a police chief call me not too long ago. He says, I don't like the way things are going. What's the first thing that you'd want me to do? I said, change the color of your uniforms. The black uniforms a lot of policemen wear, I actually had a group of students from the University of Virginia. They did a research project for me. I wanted to know where the uniforms came from. Why black? Because when I grew up, they were brown and blue. And they came back and sent me the paper, and I flipped it open. They had some pictures, and lo and behold, the first picture I saw and the other pictures were Nazis standing there with ball hats on, by the way, in their black outfits. It's the authority of color. I mean, excuse me, it's the color of authority. And you're supposed to be afraid of it. And so there are a lot of things going on, mental things, psychological things that affect police and the way they're going. And a lot of policemen don't understand it sometimes, why they're acting that way.
Denise in Springfield has an email for you. She says, what kind of jeopardy might your guest experience by bringing this information to light?
Jeopardy? Well, I know I'm watched. I'll give you, and this is a true story. My wife actually emailed a fellow we know that used to work in the Secret Service and asked him why all the military operations are going on in an area of Virginia. He emailed back a paragraph basically saying it's the Navy SEAL. They're using the mountains in Virginia as similar to Pakistan. The next day, he was visited by the NSA, two guys from the NSA, and they told him they would actually deport him outside the country if he contacted us anymore. Well, he came to my office like 2 days later and just sat there and cried. This is a guy that served. He's a former Army veteran, and he's gotten kind of militant now. But you know you're being watched today. Be careful. You know, I tell people, you know, be careful when you come out of a movie and that movie doesn't you don't like the movie and you say the movie bombed. You use the word bomb. You're going right into a central computer. So I know that we're being watched. I mean, I had an NSA agent tell me it's a trillion downloads a month from the internet. Everything we're doing, and the FBI admitted 2.5 months ago on CNN they're downloading our phone calls. So. For whatever reason, the average American is someone to be watched now.
This is a pre-recorded edition of The Exchange, so you're not going to hear the phone number and the email address given out because, since we're pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today.
We have a full bank of phone calls waiting to talk to you in the final 10 minutes here. Let's go to John in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Whitehead, who's written A Government of Wolves.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I just had a comment more than a question. My wife actually works for the federal government in the Department of Social Security. Their enforcement here is two guards that are subcontractors. And the reason was explained, and this is actually from several law enforcement people that I know, the reason that they've gone to hollow point bullets is that they have far more impact when they're used against bulletproof vests than a standard jacket and shell.
Interesting. So that assumes that the people attacking them are going to be wearing vests?
All of the law enforcement agencies out there now assume that if they come under attack, the person will be wearing a bulletproof vest. And the last incident that happened at the Social Security Administration here never made the paper, but the guy was in a bulletproof vest.
All right. John in Medford, thank you. John Whitehead, did I hear you giggling?
I think occasionally people might have, you know, military vests in this country, but all the cases I cover in my book, and they're a legion. No one has armored vests on or anything. They're kids, former vets, those kind of things are getting blown away. You know, the case of Jose Guerrero, which I detail in my book, they did a SWAT team raid on his home looking for marijuana, and the flashbang grenade went off in his home. He got at the end of the hallway, put his wife and kid in the closet because they thought they were being robbed. He was holding his hunting rifle. They fired over 90 bullets at him. 50 hit him, killed him. He falls face down. The police would not let the medics take care of him. He bled to death. They claimed he shot at him. An investigation showed he had never taken the safety off his rifle. So those are the kind of cases I'm seeing. I have yet to detail very few cases where people have any kind of vest on or those kind of things. No.
All right. Brad in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Whitehead.
Yes, thank you. I'm very alarmed at the glorification of all things militaristic and police-related in our country. Even our fire department acts that way these days. We're way over-policed. Here in town, the police lurk and pass out these enormously expensive tickets for minor, little tiny things, and there's no recourse other than to pay these huge fines. We have a TV station that runs constant shows of cops throwing people on the ground, pointing guns at their head. It's very alarming. And we had two sheriffs here in our area, sir, that our county and the adjacent county, who came out and said they would not enforce federal gun laws if the gun laws were coming down. And it raises an interesting question in my mind. Who polices the police? Who's in charge of these guys? What if we did have kind of like a fascist mentality that wanted to impose a conservative way on our society? Who would be in charge of these guys? Who is in charge now? Other than elections, I don't think we have any recourse against our own police. Well, and I don't think we have any protection. We don't have citizen review boards to review how militaristic they're getting and how arrogant they can sometimes seem. So I'm alarmed about this, and I wish I had good relations with our police, but then here in our town, I'm feeling like it's gotten worse and worse over the last few years.
All right, thanks for that, Brad. John, thoughts?
Yeah, there are some good movements in that direction. There are some former policemen who are starting what they call police accountability review boards. That's a good idea. The local city councils in most towns that are supposedly supervising the police don't do a good job, and they're really not trained to do that. So I think these review commissions by former policemen and attorneys and regular citizens are a good idea. Otherwise, there's not a lot of supervision. And also, police have what's called qualified immunity. When they kill somebody by accident, it's virtually nothing you can do about that, except in what I call crazy cases. One of the recent trends that I'm seeing is the body probing phenomenon. And these are actual cases I detail in the book. It's all I have 30 pages of footnotes in my book, by the way. I'm not a conspiratorialist.
Yes, I noticed that they got really high on the numbers.
A lot of footnotes, yeah. These rectum searches occurring on streets, Milwaukee, Oakland, I mean, causing bleeding in Milwaukee. There have been lawsuits filed on that. There's a big lawsuit that was won in Oakland for rectum searches on streets. This time last year, Ashley Dobbs and her niece were driving through Texas. Supposedly, Ashley threw a cigarette out of the car. The policeman pulled her over and asked if she had marijuana. She said no. They pulled her and her niece out of the car and did rectum and vaginal searches on them without changing the gloves on the side of the highway. They've sued for a million and a half, and they're going to win the case. But that's the kind of stuff you're seeing. I think what's happened, and this is key, our government starts with those three beautiful words, our Constitution, our government, we the people. It used to be in this country that the policemen saw themselves as servants and our federal government agents saw themselves as servants of the people. In fact, on the side of police cars, it used to have serve, defend, protect. Where I live locally now, those phrases are all gone. So there's just been a change in the mentality of how the government views us, not as the American people being the masters, but as the servants.
Is that a change back, though, John? Because if you look at movies from the 30s and 40s, there's a lot of hard-boiled policemen saying, come on, people, move it along. You're nothing to see. Cracking heads open without, you know, barely a mention. I don't know how close those are to the actual truth of the times, but certainly in popular culture, there was a perception that police were like this earlier.
Yeah, there's always been in this country a distrust of police. In fact, there are a lot of good historical books on that, yeah. In early America, most policemen wore, in very early America, they didn't wear uniforms. They wore just regular suits with a badge, and that was it. And that's a good thing, by the way, a good trend maybe, but we're never going to go back to that. I mean, we're in the black outfits, the black-clad outfits, and the armored vehicles and all the things you see today. In fact, these new SWAT team raids are having now, that the police actually wear masks, black masks. All you can see are their eyes. And this is supposedly a country that's a democracy where we don't have stormtroopers. But it looks like that's where we're headed. But again, there's a lot of things Americans can do. And the first thing I tell Americans is learn your Bill of Rights, teach your kids the Bill of Rights at home. Education precedes action. Don't just sit around being entertained all the time. As Orwell talks about in Brave New World, the future he saw, people would just be distracted all the time. They wouldn't know what's going on. And again, when I'm writing these details in my books or my commentaries, which I do weekly, this is stuff that I see all the time. Most Americans go, gee, I didn't know this was happening. Well, it's been going on for 30 years. Where have you been? So I don't think, again, I don't want people to go away from this feeling helpless. It's not a helpless situation. You can take proactive steps, but you have to, and again, I think locally is the best way to begin. Act locally, think nationally. You can change things in your local community.
Not going to be able to get all the calls in here, but let's go to Steve in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Whitehead.
Yeah, this is Steve Lansford. I'm here in Wairika, and we are active. A number of us are very active in taking our government back. And yes, the author is right. It starts with being educated. The more I learn, the more educated I have to be, to quote, to the positions of power that are in my face, that they are unconstitutional, and it's not within our Constitution for them to even be questioning me at this moment for whatever case it may be, like up in our forest getting firewood out of my forest. It's not their forest, it's our forest. And we need to take our forest back and our power back. And the only way we can do that is in our verbiage, which we say that, you know, I am not going to be under your power, I am under the people's power. And we have to be very clear where we're coming from today, because this movement is so strong and so vast and so powerful already that we are way behind the ball, and the people have to take responsibility. And thank you very much for you guys being on the air.
Thank you, Steve. Let's go to Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Whitehead.
Yeah, 3 points, questions. the crime rates have been going down in the cities, but it seems that there's a rapid increase in reports of police crime on the person. And who's doing the counting, and where is it being published on the Internet? So that people can know what's going on. Then second question is, how is all of the surveillance affecting talk radio, which I, you know, how am I being surveilled now in relationship to other people talking about this? And then the third thing is, please discuss more about, you mentioned earlier, disappearances, disappearing people into mental hospitals. And I would close by saying that the spirit of the Soviet Union went into the our country when we prated around saying that we defeated the Soviet Union.
All right. Thanks for the call, Carter. Appreciate that. John, thoughts?
Yeah, you go to our website, Rutherford.org. We have all the statistics, commentaries on the things you're talking about, the crime rates and et cetera. What were the other questions?
He was talking about talk radio and whether there's...
Oh, yeah, to give you a good example. We've had a several talk radio hosts, by the way, who are get a little radical. They one actually that we helped out, he went home the next day, and on his door was a note. It was one of those little hookies around the doorknob, and it said, interview by the FBI. The FBI wanted to interview him on what he was saying on the radio. Of course, we intervened in that the FBI didn't do the interview, but... As far as surveilling you, yes. As I said, anything digital, your phone calls, if they want to focus on a radio interview I'm doing, who's calling in, obviously they can do that. There's nothing really limiting what's happening. And with the coming of drones pretty soon, 2015, they're saying 30,000 of those are going to be flying over the United States by 2020. The thing about drones, people say, well, aren't they like helicopters? Not really, because they have miniature drones now, mosquito drones, hummingbird drones. You're going to be watched everywhere you go. I mean, you'll look at a bird in a tree and you won't know it. And again, that's all on our website, and I detail that in my book. We moved into a new paradigm. Technology is driving the show. I think you have to become technologically adept. You have to study it. You have to know how to deal with it. You have to do your own research. Don't sit and watch, because if you're watching some silly program. These and great NPR shows like this are great. They're getting the information out. So stay informed. Freedom is the responsibility of every American. You got to do it.
Replace fear with knowledge.
Yes.
All right. John Whitehead, the author of A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank
on the
you,
Jefferson
sir.
Exchange. And that'll do it for today's exchange. Thanks for joining us for this revisit with John Whitehead from August of 2013. Emily Curitan's our producer from JPR News. Colleen Pike at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day.